Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, today we'll start a hearing from the candidates who took us up on our offer of free airtime for political candidates who are running on November 3rd. And we'll also talk about the presidential election. And we'll hear two fascinating interviews from our HD3 channel. Well, this is 88.5 FM. For the last several years, WMNF has offered free airtime to candidates who are on the ballot. And we figure that it's one way for candidates to get their messages out. We're doing this for candidates of any party who are whose name is on the ballot on November 3rd. So today and tomorrow and on Thursday morning, we'll hear from candidates. Today, we'll hear from two candidates. The first candidate is running for a state house seat. This is in southern Hillsborough County in northern Manatee County. Here's our first candidate who took us up on our offer of free airtime.
Hello, I'm Scott Mr. H. Hodenstein, and I'm running for state representative in District 57, which covers southeast Hillsborough County, including Lithia, Riverview, south of Boyette Road, Sun City Center, Waimama, Gibsonton, Balm, and parts of Valrico, Ruskin, Dover, and Apollo Beach. As a husband of 23 years to a school counselor, as a father to two teenage sons, as a veteran, and as a current teacher, I am the best choice to represent all the residents of District 57. I've been a public servant my entire adult life. I joined the Navy when I was 17, graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy, and served for 24 years with command experience and multiple deployments. After retirement, I became a middle school civics teacher and was named a 2019 Hillsborough County Teacher of the Year finalist. In each of my professions, I've always succeeded at getting the job done and taking care of people, which is what we need as we emerge from the COVID-19 crisis. I believe the state legislature should focus on what will benefit all Floridians, not just a select few. We need better public education, public health, and public service if we want a better future for our children. We must start by electing representatives who will work for the public interest, not special interest. I have endorsements from Vote Vets, Every Town for Gun Safety, the Florida Nurses Association, and Hillsborough County Teachers Association, among many more. You can learn more about my life of public service and my plans for District 57 at www.mrh4fl57.org. Check me out, and then please vote for me, Mr. H, in this election.
That's Scott Hodenstein, who is running for State House District 57, and he was the first one to take us up on our offer of free airtime. Next, we're going to hear from a candidate for the Pasco County Commission.
Hi, I'm Jessica Stimpian, Democratic candidate for Pasco County Commissioner District 3. You don't have to live in District 3 to vote for me. I'm a Pasco County native, born and am raising my son with my husband in the same neighborhood that I grew up in. We are small business owners. I am a former teacher, a meeting facilitator, a community advocate, and an environmental scientist. I have been working at the government levels, at the local, regional, and state levels for over 20 years. I started out teaching, then moved into working for the Hillsborough County Health Department, permitting and inspecting septic systems. I landed a job with the Florida Department of Agriculture and the Office of Ag Water Policy, working with farmers in the field, helping them understand their role in protecting natural resources. I have been working for the department for over 13 years. I moved up into managing teams, then strategic planning, emergency response coordination, and currently I'm the water policy coordinator for the Southwest District. I'm an active community member. For 3 years, I led a 4-H club teaching youth leadership skills, the importance of agriculture and environmental stewardship. I'm also the founding member of the Sierra Pines Coalition, where we work on mitigating our stormwater and flooding issues in our neighborhood. We've had a lot of success working with agencies and stakeholders, finding solutions to our problems that weren't a burden to the taxpayer or the county. But what I realized was missing was an advocate at the local level to push forward a collective message for us. That's why I'm running, to work on stormwater and flooding issues, managing growth and preservation. Those issues are important to me, and I'm hearing all around the county they're important to you, too. So I hope you vote. Go to the go to the polls early or on November 3rd, visit StempianForPasco.com, and I hope you vote for me, Jessica Stempian, Democratic candidate, Pasco County Commissioner, District 3.
That was Jessica Stempian from Pasco County running for the County Commission District 3. And we'll have more candidates' messages tomorrow. We're giving free airtime to candidates. Don't wait till the last minute. Beginning today, WMNF is providing free airtime for political candidates during this hour, Radioactivity. Candidates whose names appear on Florida's November 3rd ballot are invited to record campaign messages of up to 2 minutes on our comment line, which is 813-238-8001. Extension 115. This offer is open to every candidate, no matter their political party or no matter what office they're running for. Messages should be recorded by the candidates themselves. Please leave a contact number at the end in case we have any questions. The contact phone number will not be aired. WMNF's prime signal area includes Hillsborough, Pinellas, Sarasota, Pasco, Polk, and Manatee counties. We're hoping the candidates' messages will give our listeners some background about the person and the issues on which they're running. Messages can include the campaign's website. Messages that go over 2 minutes will be edited to fit the 2-minute limit. Again, WMNF is offering free airtime for candidates. Candidates can begin recording their campaign messages right now by calling 813-238-8001, extension 115. The candidates' messages will be aired tomorrow. During the 11 o'clock hour, the deadline to record a message for air is 9 a.m. this Thursday, October 22nd. Messages received after 9 a.m. October 22nd will not receive airtime. So there you have it. So thanks to the two candidates who called in. This is 88.5 FM. We're going to do something a little bit different today, and that is that we're going to go to our HD3 channel, which is all news and talk. And we're going to hear some, just give you a sample of some of the interesting programs that are over there. It's news and talk 24 hours a day, including programs that originally air on the BBC and that come to us from NPR, that come to us from the Pacifica Radio Network and community radio stations around the country. So today we're going to go to Los Angeles community radio station, KPFK, and we're going to listen to two interviews that Ian Masters, who hosts a program there every afternoon. We're going to hear two interviews he did about the upcoming election. The first one with a professor who teaches at Harvard, and let's listen in on this interview. And you can get HD3 very easily by using an HD radio or just your computer. You can go to wmnf.org/listen. And select to listen to HD3, or you can get the WMNF app on your phone. And there are four different channels on our phone app that you can listen to. There's actually two music channels, then there's our main channel, and then there's the all news and talk channel, which is called the Source HD3. So let's listen in on this interview about the presidential election here on 88.5 FM.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Begat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at The New Yorker, Trump, the Coronavirus, and What Happens When Strongmen Fall Ill. And her new book, out soon, is Strongmen, From Mussolini to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Gyat.
Thank you.
So I think Mussolini came to mind with a lot of people when Trump left the helicopter after he discharged himself from Walter Reed. Apparently he took a big hit of oxygen and then strode across the White House lawn, up the stairs, and stood on the balcony in a very strange way. He took off his mask, put it in his pocket, jutted his jaw out like Mussolini, and just stood there for the longest time. And then after a while, he saluted no one in particular. It was quite a surreal moment. And you wrote about it in the piece that you wrote for The New Yorker. So obviously, in a facile way, there's a comparison between Trump and Mussolini, and people have noticed it before because of the way he stands and juts his jaw out. But I take it you feel that the comparisons are much deeper than the superficial ones that we're talking about.
I do. There is all of that, and the use of the body and the gestures he makes are very reminiscent. As is this cultivation of a personality cult, because Trump understands very well that his success hinges on him being this kind of super macho leader who can survive things that normal men could not. And that is one of the cardinal rules of the authoritarian personality cult, that they are, in the past, they used to be, you know, accorded magical powers, or they're reigning through divine benediction. And this still holds with Trump, where Mike Pompeo and many evangelicals say he's there by the will of God. But that episode on the balcony was also interesting because, as you said, Trump just stood there for the longest time and he didn't say anything. Then later he went in and he had a whole video speech. And he spoke with his body, both in tearing off the mask in this kind of disdainful way. This was playing to his supporters, because he's a rogue. Right? He's not going to play by the rules. And so it was almost like, think of the American Western, you know, you're tearing off the mask in this macho way. But he also stood there silently because he knows that for the authoritarian leader-follower relationship to work, he has to reassure them that he's there. So there's something very statue-like with these men. They're very theatrical, but they also have to be solid as a statue, and you can count on them. So the whole set design of this balcony thing, when he stood there with the flags, was just to reassure them that he was there for them. And he understands that very, very well, just like Mussolini did.
And of course, the speech that he televised shortly thereafter was the one in which he said, "I dominated, and I'm immune." And his supporters created an Arnold Schwarzenegger-type meme calling it Trump the Trumpinator. So that is, I guess, the only thing that we missed, and frankly, I wish he would have done it, is him opening up his shirt to show a Superman T-shirt underneath. Are you sorry that that didn't happen?
No, not really. I mean, it's enough that we know that he wanted it to happen. But what's also interesting about that, when we think about how propaganda works and how influenced Trump is by his circles of followers, that in the days before he said that, his followers were circulating on Facebook an actual mock-up of what were supposed to be his chest x-rays, and they showed a Superman sign. And we know from the way he retweets unknown people who are his right-wing followers that he and his staff really look at these memes and these images. So that's an example where I wouldn't be surprised if he got a flood of these kind of images of his x-ray as Superman and then just got the idea from them. And then this again is this kind of flow of love that goes on between the leader and this core of followers. And he always is going to pander to them, and he's always going to elevate that. And it's often elevating the worst instincts.
Well, when you mention him retweeting in Thursday's town hall on NBC, where Trump was challenged by Samantha Guthrie about his QAnon retweet, the content of the QAnon retweet was that there's this dreadful idea that they're putting forth, along with their other stuff about Hillary Clinton eating babies and drinking blood and Democrats cavorting with demons and worshipping Satan. The QAnon piece that he retweeted was about the idea that Obama did not bring about the end of bin Laden, the capture and killing of bin Laden, but in fact Obama and Joe Biden are murdering the SEAL Team 6 guys who conducted the raid to cover up the fact that they never got bin Laden. I mean, that is literally the insanity of it. But I bring them up because both this dreadful idea that QAnon has, that the Democratic Party and a bunch of Hollywood celebrities are running a pedophile ring and drinking babies' bloods and worshipping Satan and cavorting with demons, that's taking the idea of the loyal opposition beyond any point of redemption. They are just beyond the pale. And in fact, Trump said in the debate when he, in justifying QAnon, he said, well, they're against pedophilia. I mean, and then if he takes away Obama's great success in nailing Osama bin Laden, he's also, it also has a political purpose, does it not?
Yes, and one of the things that we look for when you're thinking, is this person have autocratic tendencies? One of them, and Trump checks, unfortunately for us, Trump checks every single box that there is. Is that they, where do they see themselves in history? So they promise greatness, right? But it's making the nation great again. So there's also nostalgia. And what that means is that there's a recall to some mythical past when America was, you know, excellent in this case, when, you know, whites were not challenged by non-whites, when women knew their place. But it also means that many of them demonize the ruler who came before. And in the case of several rulers in history, they have this kind of furious will to annihilate the memory of the person who came before. So Trump wants to undo everything that Obama did or discredit it in some way, because they can't stand the fact that, you know, these former rulers were far more popular than they are. And so there's this kind of fury is the only word for it, and which spreads to a political agenda that is supposed to undo everything that they did. And that's why he's there was a study done in the first 2 years of his time in office. He, you know, tweeted more about Obama than anybody else, because it's like people say Obama lives in his head. And this is true of other rulers in history. Pinochet in Chile did this with Allende, who became like the devil incarnate. So this is part of the syndrome of making themselves be the savior, unlike any other man who ever governed.
And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been a recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda and the politics of images, and it has an article at The New Yorker, Trump, the Coronavirus and What Happens When Strong Men Fall Ill. And her new book out soon is Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. So I guess in attempting to extinguish Obama's legacy, to some extent, Trump has been successful. But it should have become apparent to everybody, literally, I think on the day after his inauguration, he forced his press secretary to go out and argue that the crowd for Trump's inauguration was bigger than the crowd for Obama's inauguration, when the pictures side by side indicated the opposite. So I think that is a pretty good example of what you're saying, is it not?
Yeah, and well, it's very interesting now when we're at the end of his first term, hopefully his only term, that to go back to see those early moments, and of course we had ample evidence during the campaign, that, you know, from his, you know, declaration that he could shoot somebody and get away with it, not lose any followers, all of the things he did during the campaign. But the first acts as president are really important. And what that told us was that he was going to force all those who were working for him to believe in his false reality. And so making the press secretary go out and recite these false, patently false statistics was also a power play that set the tone for the kind of administration he's had and his domestication of the GOP, that loyalty is all that matters. And everything, I call Trump a personalist ruler. And personalist rulers, and they can rule in a democracy like Berlusconi did, or they can rule in an old-fashioned dictatorship. But when you have one, they alone control all these patronage networks and their version of truth, which suits their private needs to stay in office, to avoid prosecution, to get rich. That is the only criterion for serving in their government, for doing anything. And slowly, the party and the press secretary, all of these functions of government and important positions become wrapped around the trying to please the president. And politics gets kind of depleted of its meaning because everything is only about the leader and his welfare. So that is that example of making him trot out there and say this and everyone agreeing with him, and then Kellyanne Conway talking about alternative facts is very interesting to go back to now after we've had 20,000 falsehoods told by Trump.
So do you think, though, since you've studied fascist leaders like Mussolini and Hitler, and there are obviously a bunch of clones out there today and wannabes like Duterte and Bolsonaro, Orban, etc. What do you think of Bertolt Brecht's notion in that play of his, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Huy, where he reduced Hitler down to a small-time Chicago racketeer trying to take over the cauliflower concession at the Chicago markets, and the idea being that we judge these tyrants like Hitler and Mussolini on the numbers of corpses they piled up in the countries that they conquered and devastated, rather than expose them as the kind of weak, frail, absurd, pathetic human beings that they were.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And when we talk about the cults of personality that all of these men have, and they spend a huge amount of time and resources in maintaining them, because these cults have to be maintained. There's a reason that they're all about presenting the leader as all-powerful, as, you know, you don't want to cross him. Because in fact, and as everyone who works for him knows, they are weak, frail, incompetent people. Their governments are extremely chaotic. There's this myth of authoritarian efficiency, that we bring law and order, we make the trains run on time. In fact, if you look at how their governments operate behind the scenes, it's constant, you know, parade hiring and firing people, it's reversing policies, and of course, we don't learn, the public then doesn't learn anything about this because of censorship, right, when you have a real one-party state. So what we've been experiencing with this record high turnover in government and, you know, mass kind of passive and active purges of the State Department and all the other federal agencies, all this chaos and upheaval is very typical of authoritarian rule. And it's all government arranges itself around the personality deficiencies and quirks and strangenesses and individual obsessions of the ruler. And that's how democracy falls sometimes, is by having a very incompetent and flawed leader, and everything goes down to his level. So that's what we have been experiencing. And thus they have to puff themselves up, and their collaborators are only too happy to puff them up to be instead infallible, even immune from coronavirus, unbeatable, invincible. So Brecht was completely right.
So just in closing, there are, of course, fears that he won't leave office. He's already said that he won't agree or won't commit to a peaceful transition of power, as has his vice president, Mike Pence. It's pretty appalling and rather scary. So there are two scenarios. Either there'll be a civil war on election day and thereafter, which will, of course, serve Putin's ends to divide America and ridicule the notion of democracy itself. But there's another possibility, and that is it's rather like the ending of the movie The Wizard of Oz. You pull back the curtain, and there's this weak, frightened man. And we see glimpses of that, frankly. On Thursday night at the town hall meeting, there were glimpses of it. And in the debate, the one debate he did with Biden, and apparently in person, he's just out of control and ridiculous and screaming and so out of his depth, it's just sad. But is it possible that this weak, strong man will finally be exposed?
He's being exposed every time the death toll goes up from coronavirus, and you know the question is whether his core of followers is enough to to keep him in office. And of course, about how what happens after the election, a lot determines what the GOP does. And it's, you know, we rightly focus on Trump, but Trump is nothing without the GOP. He has, and the real, you know, the story is also how did he get these people to collaborate with him, which is typical of authoritarians. Once the elites sign on and make their deals, they stick with the leader to the bitter end. And we'll see what happens. You know, even McConnell, who's been his biggest enabler, has said no, you know, that we'll be respecting what happens with the election. So it's hard to say, but certainly authoritarian minded people like Trump, the prospect of them losing power, they're not regular leaders who just think, okay, I'll go have my library and curate my legacy. For them, it's like a psychological annihilation. So they get very desperate and they do very desperate things if they think they're losing or coming out of power in some way. So we will see what happens, but what the GOP does will also set the tone.
Well, Ruth Ben-Gyat, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Gyat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. And she has an article at The New Yorker, Trump, the Coronavirus, and What Happens When Strongmen Fall Ill. And her new book out soon is Strongmen, From Mussolini to the Present. And joining us now is Dr. Ian Lipkin, who's the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, who has over 30 years of experience.
We're going to hear more of Ian Masters and background briefing in just a moment. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to hear, this is a program that we're listening to right now. This is a program that airs every afternoon at 4 o'clock on WMNF's HD3 channel, the All News and Talk channel. And Ian gets some of the best professors, intellectuals, authors, and activists on his program. And he does a wonderful job of doing these interviews. So we're hearing this today. We'll go back to our regular format tomorrow. But let's listen to one more interview that Ian did earlier this week. This is an interview he did about the inside world of QAnon and Trump's deadly conspiracies. Here is more of Ian Masters' program, Background Briefing, which comes to us from the community radio station in Los Angeles.
At backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Carl Hoffman, the author of the New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, hailed as a masterpiece by Outside and named a New York Times Editor's Choice and one of the Washington Post's 50 notable works of nonfiction for 2014, as well as the Lunatic Express. And he's a former contributing editor to National Geographic Traveler and Wired and has traveled on assignment to 80 countries. And his latest book is Liar's Circus, A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside-Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Hoffman.
Thanks so much.
So, Carl, you've had firsthand experience in the world of, well, in Trump world, I guess. You've spent months going to Trump's rallies and getting to know his diehard supporters, and your book offers a frightening portrait of perhaps as many as 10 million Americans who have the most unhinged belief systems and are attracted to a leader with a sort of cult-like fervor whose make-believe presidency feeds them a fantasy of an America in which the coronavirus has gone away and much of the QAnon belief system is anchored in this peculiar idea that the Democratic Party is run by pedophiles along with Hollywood movie stars who torture babies, drink their blood, cavort with demons, and worship Satan. And this came up, believe it or not, in the town hall meeting that NBC allowed Trump to have on last Thursday. He had refused to do the debate as scheduled, so Biden did his town hall on ABC, and NBC afforded Trump an hour in which Savannah Guthrie asked him a question about QAnon, And his response was just absolutely extraordinary. He certainly didn't disavow it. So you've experienced the people who believe Trump's worldview. And how many people believe, as Trump does, in conspiracies like QAnon?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. You mentioned the figure 10 million. I don't know where that figure comes from. I would say, you know, easily tens of millions of people. I mean, you know, who knows? But I will say that, you know, what I did was to go from Trump across America, from Trump rally to Trump rally in last fall and through into the winter. And, you know, so I would, and I spent almost 200 hours in parking lots and hanging out with Trump super fans and was tailgating, more or less, at Trump rallies. And I mean, there was almost, when I went into the project, it was my kind of assumption that things like QAnon and other, you know, there's lots of conspiracy theories. They're not all specifically Q related, but they all kind of intersect in a certain way. And that, you know, those, my assumption was that those things were fringe, you know, that only, you know, a few kind of nuts believed in those things. And, you know, I found completely opposite. I mean, there's almost nobody, obviously, at a 22,000 person rally, you know, I wasn't able to speak with everybody, but almost every single person that I talked to and that I spent time with in one way or another believed at some level of QAnon and these other things, whether it's that, you know, Hillary Clinton murdered JFK Jr. because he was threatening to run for the Senate, and or that, you know, Michelle Obama has a penis. I mean, she's a man, her real name is Michael, and the kids are adopted. Or, you know, the central tenet of Q, which is, of course, that, you know, John Podesta and Hillary and other Democrats in their orbit are, you know, sort of the kingmakers of this giant, far-reaching pedophile ring. You know, and you can, there's a video, for instance, that people would tell me about, and they'd be like, you know, you can hear the babies crying in the tunnels, and you can hear John Podesta laughing. And, you know, when you talk to those people, like, as I mean, people say that stuff all the time.
Well, it's mind-blowing, but it also serves an extremely dark political end. There's always been opposition research that political parties do on each other, and invariably some scandal emerges. But this takes it way beyond opposition research. It paints your opposition party, in this case the Democrats, as baby killers, blood-drinking pedophiles who worship Satan and cavort with demons. I mean, it's just so far beyond the pale. Is that the political purpose of this? In other words, to paint your opposition as completely beyond redemption? And frankly,
well, I mean, you know, I think partly it's to suggest that and to say that, but it's also, I think, you know, meant to just spin this world that is so upside down, and that in which truth is so subverted that you don't know what's true and what's not true. I mean, you know, the Trump himself, I mean, you know, on Thursday night he said, you know, I had to retweet, he was, Savannah Guthrie sort of took him to task over retweeting this conspiracy theory that Obama had not in fact killed Osama bin Laden, you know, Trump said, well, I just retweeted it. It wasn't really me. I was just retweeting it, and I have to retweet it because the fake news doesn't report what I say. And, or, you know, you're at a rally and Trump, I mean, constantly, it's not, again, these things are not peripheral. They're central. There is the call that the real news is fake, and that, you know, what the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal do is fake, is made up. It's all part of this deep state plot to get Donald Trump, and that, you know, you'll hear, I mean, there used to be a line that I always, that just because it was so clear, you know, there's this jumbotron that gets up, set up in it rallies and very early in the morning of the day of the rally. And so people who are standing in line are subject to this on an hour long loop over and over and over again. You know, and there was Brad Parscale before he fell from grace, Trump's former campaign manager, who says, you know, the single greatest threat to America is the fake news. And that is, you know, that's the dark part. This idea that you're subverting the truth, and that the one source of true of news isn't news. So then you're throwing it all in. It's not, you know, it's baby killing. It's all of these crazy things, and people are completely bamboozled.
And again, I'm speaking with Kyle Hoffman, the author of the New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, hailed as a masterpiece by Outside and named a New York Times Editor's Choice and one of the Washington Post's 50 most notable works of fiction for 2014, as well as The Lunatic Express. He's a former contributing editor to National Geographic Travel and Wired, and has traveled on assignment to 80 countries. And his latest book is Liar's Circus: A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside-Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies. But again, when Savannah Guthrie brought up the fact that Trump retweeted this conspiracy theory of QAnons, that the President Obama didn't really capture and kill Osama bin Laden. In fact, it's worse than that. Obama and company and Biden are murdering the SEAL Team 6 to cover up the fact that the whole raid and killing of bin Laden was a fake. Now, again, that has a political purpose. That was, in many ways, was one of Obama's triumphs. And you recall that at the press club dinner where Obama had done, he knew that they'd killed bin Laden and the news was just about to break. But he made fun of Trump and his apprentice show. And you can see
Trump has never forgotten.
Exactly. You can see on Trump's face, because he's a narcissist, and narcissists can't handle humiliation. So many people think that motivated him to run against Obama. So there's another side to that story. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, there's that personal side, but I mean, I think ultimately it's all, you know, everything Trump does is to set up this both kind of an opposition. I mean, you know, the people are always hoping that Trump will kind of come out chastened, whether it's after he got COVID or, you know, there's people are gunned down in a synagogue, and that he'll come out and sort of make, say, a message of reconciliation. But he doesn't, because he can't. I mean, it's not only because he can't, because it's not in his making, but I think his whole, you know, his strategy is fundamentally built on this opposition, and you know, that there are, if you go to a rally, I mean, to listen to him, it's that, you know, the Democrats are coming, and there, he doesn't even call them Democrats. You know, the socialists, Marxists, communists are coming, and they're coming after you, and they're coming after your guns, they're coming after your religion, they're coming after your livelihood, they're coming after your way of life. And if you don't, and they're, you know, burning and looting, and if you don't support me, the Savior, you know, this is what you're going to get. And all of these conspiracy theories are part and parcel of that, and they're all built on, you know, subverting the truth and making it so that nobody knows what is true. And, you know, talking about QAnon specifically, you know, he was pressed to disavow QAnon, and he wouldn't. And, you know, that sort of shows you that, you know, how widespread Q is, this idea that, you know, if there were only a few, if it was truly a fringe movement, he would be happy to denounce it. But, you know, to denounce QAnon is to denounce his, you know, his whole base.
Well, that's a frightening thought. We don't know how big his base is, but he's polling at something like 42% to Biden's 54%. So,
and these he won 63 million votes in 2016. I mean,
right.
You know, we forget that sometimes. That's
right.
A lot of people.
So how many of that 63 million do you think are QAnon believers? We just don't know. But
we don't know, but
there are enough for him not to want to disavow them because he can't afford to lose anyone in his base. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't want to disavow. I mean, part of it's that he doesn't want to ever disavow anything. You know, he doesn't want to ever admit that he's wrong, ever. I mean, that's just his narcissistic, sociopathic personality. But part of it's political. I mean, that's his very base. You know, those are his most stalwart supporters. Those are the people that come to the rallies. I mean, he's rallying at this point. He's rallying every day and sometimes multiple times a day. Friday morning, I'm seeing tweets from one of the characters in my book, Rick Frazier, who also sends me texts. And he's in line in Macon, Georgia. There's a rally this afternoon, and he's there at 8 in the morning. He was the first in line. And that line stretches, you know, it looks like it stretches a half a mile in a field. And people are dressed in their full MAGA regalia and shouting Trump's name. And I looked at that, and, you know, among that core base, there's certainly no dissolution of his diminishment of his support.
Well, it is an extraordinary phenomenon. And, of course, Savannah Guthrie on Thursday at the town hall, you know, when he kept Trump saying, you know, he knows nothing about it. And then he went on to say, but I understand they're very much against pedophilia, which is not, about. It's not that they're against pedophilia. They believe that the Democratic Party is run by pedophiles. It's a convenient dodge there. And then, you know, and then she basically, in trying to avoid culpability for retweeting this disgusting conspiracy theory that Obama and Biden had the SEAL Team 6 people killed because the capturing and killing of bin Laden was a fake. She said, you know, but, you know, you're the President of the United States. You're not some crazy uncle. I mean, that's where we're at, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And the way that the President's always saying, you know, I don't know anything about that. I don't know about that is such a crazy thing to say. I mean, he's supposed to be the most well-informed president in the country. If he's not informed, then who is? And yet he, you know, obviously knew enough about QAnon. Yeah, I mean, it's total nonsense. I mean, he knows all about QAnon. Though I will say, like, at the rallies in the, I haven't been to this newest round of rallies, but certainly through the fall, if you went into a rally with a QAnon shirt, for instance, you know, with a shirt that had a big Q, security would often come and tell you to turn that shirt inside out or take it off because they were afraid of the press that how people would be reacting to you know, word that Trump was embracing the QAnon conspiracy. I don't know if that's holding true anymore. I mean, the cat's kind of out of the bag.
But just in closing, though, the QAnon conspiracy is premised on the idea that there's somebody called Q inside the government who's leaking stuff to the Trump supporters about the deep state's terrible activities, and that the QAnon followers are waiting for Trump to signal the storm, which is when the Democratic opposition will be rounded up and sent to Guantanamo, or these deep state traitors, and particularly those in the press, will be taken to military camps and executed. So that's what they believe, and they're waiting for Trump to signal the storm. That's a big tenet of their belief system, isn't it?
That's correct. And that the whole, it also gets wrapped up in religion. I mean, that there's this whole idea that Trump was heaven sent and that he was sent to create, to fight this pedophilia, and that is the reason, for instance, the wall is being built. It's not really so much to prevent migrants from coming in as it is to stop so-called human trafficking. And, you know, we're not talking about human trafficking like, you know, underage Eastern European prostitutes in Moldavia or something, but the trafficking of small children for the purpose of, you know, extracting their fluids.
My God.
It's really incredible that America has come to this.
Well, Carl, I thank you again for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. A pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Carl Hoffman, is the author of the New York Times bestseller Savage Harvest, hailed as a masterpiece by Outside and named a New York Times Editor's Choice and one of the Washington Post's 50 most notable works of fiction for 2014, as well as The Lunatic Express. And he's a former contributing editor to National Geographic Traveler and Wired. And he has traveled on assignment to 80 countries. And his latest book, just out, is Liar's Circus, A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside-Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies.
That was the voice of Ian Masters, who hosts a program on our HD3 channel. The program is called The Background Briefing, and it airs every afternoon at 4 o'clock. And he always gets fascinating guests and topics. So if you want to listen to some interesting talk at 4 o'clock every afternoon, that's a terrific program to listen to. You can get it simply by going to wmnf.org/listen. And we're going to open up the phone lines and take some phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Tomorrow we'll have another round of free airtime for candidates, and we'll be hearing who called in. It's entirely up to the candidates whether or not they want to take part or not, but we are not going to censor their messages at all. So we'll have another round of candidate messages tomorrow at 11:06 a.m. Just a little bit of news before we take the phone calls. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Tampa police are on the scene of an officer-involved shooting. It's very early in the investigation, and information is fluid at this time, according to the Tampa Police Department. The shooting took place at 3110 North 50th Street near the Dollar General. So that's news that we'll hear more about as the day goes on. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can also email the studio. As usual, email your comments to dj@wmnf.org. Well, Florida shattered its opening day record for in-person early voting yesterday, with at least 350,000 people casting ballots yesterday, and elections officials are still counting. Trend continues a record-setting pace in the state. Voting by mail, which started earlier this month, racked up 2.5 million ballots headed into yesterday morning. That's more than double the 1.2 million during the same time frame in 2016. And the Miami Herald is reporting that armies, they use the word armies, of Florida lawyers are being deployed for the presidential election around the state. The Herald says that in Miami-Dade County alone, the election department there released a list of registered poll watchers associated with the campaigns, and there are 1,421 of them in that county, which has only 859 precincts. So that's just one county. So an army of lawyers being deployed around Florida for the presidential election. Now, again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. They just released the coronavirus report for today, and it looks like there was a slight jump in coronavirus cases. Yesterday, we had one of the lowest cases in the last 7 days, lowest number of cases in the last 7 days. The new number just announced 3,662 new cases. That's a spike from yesterday. And 86 more deaths occurred or have been reported in the last 24 hours. So we'll see if whether we stay along with the national trend, and that is an upswing in coronavirus cases. Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. And We're going to take some calls in just a moment. 813-239-9663. In fact, let's take a call right now. Barbara Fling is our phone producer today. And I'm going to bring up the call-in information here. And it looks like David in Pasco County is calling. David, thanks for calling in. What would you like to comment about?
Well, thank you for being there, Rob. And I think this might be a hotly contested election even after Election Day. Do you think that's a possibility that's going to happen with these mail-in ballots? Pennsylvania extending the mail-in date by 4 days? And do you think this election is going to have an asterisk by it?
Everybody's talking about it. If you've been reading the newspapers and watching the cable news channels, that's all they tend to talk about. I think the counting is going to take a while. During the Senate race here in Florida 2 years ago, Broward County made the mistake of not counting the mail-in ballots as soon as they got them. As we heard Craig Latimer, the supervisor of elections, tell us on the show a few days ago that he has the ability 10 or so days ahead of the election to start counting mail-in ballots.
This might go back to the days of the hanging chad, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be like that, because I think we've got rid of those kind of hanging chad ballots. I think the real key is, as long as the supervisor of elections in every county in the state begins counting the mail ballots early, as Craig Latimer says he's going to, then I don't think we're going to get backed up. The supervisor of elections in Broward County, who didn't start to count those 70,000 mail-in ballots in Broward County until Election Day, she backed up the whole state. So it took days for us to get the results, and we heard one of the candidates, Rick Scott, just complaining, saying, these election results are phony and staged, and he had all sorts of complaints and words about the election results, when in reality, the supervisor of elections was just trying to take her time counting every ballot. In the end, Scott won by just a few votes in Broward County. I think we're headed for an unusual time. I think there are going to be challenges. I think there are going to be some people whose votes are challenged. But I hope it doesn't end up being as fraught as some people are saying. Some people are saying, well, we're going to have a civil war on Election Day or the day after.
I heard that on the program just now. It's just like, I know the days leading up to most of the election are going to be tumultuous, but I just hope the days after the election aren't dangerous.
Yeah, I think everybody should keep a cool head. I think the standard should be count every vote.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what do we do about the votes that were actually thrown out, you know, like happened up there? I mean, I saw something where some votes were discarded.
Where are you talking about?
Wasn't that in Pennsylvania, some military votes or something?
Yeah, there was a story about that. It turned out not to be as bad as some outlets were reporting. And I don't have the story in front of me, so I hesitate to give you the details. But
I just wish the best for the country. At my age, I mean, I really want the best for our country.
Yeah, I think most of us do. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Rob.
Let's go to Patty in Sarasota. Hi, Patty. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
I just tuned in when your guest was talking about the Q and how Donald Trump is supposed to save children from the pedophiles of Hollywood that are drinking their fluids. So my question is, has the FBI, the CIA, found any of these children rolling in from Mexico, which I would think that would be not so concerning to him because he's locking up, you know, older kids or maybe babies too and their families. So, it seems like if this was true, right now you would have someone on the job saving these children. And then that would work really well for him for electability, wouldn't you think?
So yeah, Patty, so far there's been no proof that Hollywood stars or Democrats are collecting children and extracting precious bodily fluids from those children. And certainly the president has the power because he controls the Justice Department and the FBI. If he thinks that there is an actual conspiracy out there, he could get to the bottom of it very quickly, and he has not done that. So I think your first point is a really good one. Patty, thanks a lot. We're out of time. Thank you very much. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And be sure to tell your friends who are running for office that there is an offer of free airtime here at WMNF. Stay tuned. Coming up next, your hero, Mark Biro. And thanks to Barbara Fling, our phone producer today. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.